I guess about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, Graham called me and said that some of the speakers he'd hoped to have weren't coming, and could I talk? And I said, sure, I'll talk about the stuff I'm working on now. He said, no. Would you talk about stuff that goes back and is in some sense historical? So not knowing what I'd talk about, I said, well, what about talking about what I learned then and what I know now? And he said, no, that makes sense. Before going any further, though, I want to talk a bit about departed friends. I mean, people have mentioned Sydney. Dearly departed, had a huge influence on my life. But I'd like to mention two other people. One was Gordon Burns, who some of us remember, who also had a huge influence on my life. And then somewhat differently, and it's sort of scary when your graduate students start dying, Alan Vernon, who passed last year. No keyboard, okay. So who the hell am I? I wasn't sure who was going to be in this audience and, you know, whether I had to say who I was or wasn't, but since I know most of you and have known a number of you over the years, I guess what I did since I left Edinburgh is up there. I'll leave it up for another sort of 15 seconds and you can look at it. And it's only up there to say, well, you know, does this guy have any credibility in terms of what he learned then and what he knows now? And I would argue I have a bit.
No, you can use that.
Okay. Okay.
Or not.
Okay, there we go. So I want to talk about and just check the time, three things that I think I learned then, and just see, you know, how much of what I learned then has changed now. The first was I think, an absolutely seminal book by Fred Brooks called The Mythical Man Month that came out at some point in the 1970s. And it was subtitled Why Large Software Projects Fail. And the premise was really shown here that there was no such thing as a man month, that the notion that somehow time and people were interchangeable was just bogus. And in fact, Jeff reminded me that, you know, that one of the ways to make a late project even later was to double the number of people working on it. But I think there's a corollary to that, which I'm not sure that, and certainly Fred didn't mention then, and I'm not sure that I knew then, which is that one person for 1 year doesn't equal one person for 1 year. We know now that there are huge productivity differences in the productivity of programmers. In some cases, an order of magnitude difference, in some cases, two order of magnitude differences. So who you hire and how you exploit them is as important as the notion that you can't somehow compress time. So I guess one of the things I think I know now is how to hire software engineers. And there are really three sets of parameters that come into play. And these are in order, I think. The first is, do they have exploitable horsepower? And I very consciously don't call this intelligence, right? Because I think it's an ability to do certain tasks, and while intelligence may underpin it, raw intelligence is enough. It's the ability to actually constructively do these tasks. The first one, and I think Peter alluded to that, is the ability to reason, the ability to think. If you can't think, I would argue you can't program. The other is the ability to program, and by that I don't mean, you know, the ability to write in some particular programming language, but the ability to take that which you've constructed in your head and somehow put it down in paper and have it be executed. And then lastly, the ability to communicate. That unless you're going to work solely on your own with no one else and interact with no one else, you have to be able to communicate. You have to be able to express what you're doing and what you need other people to do. And so in some sense, when you hire people, what you've got to do is say, do they have this exploitable horsepower? Can they reason? Can they program? Can they communicate? The next thing is do they have experience, and has it been synthesized in some sense? Do they have the ability to say, that reminds me of, and that reminds me of is relevant? Now you could say, well, you know, gee, Nick, you know, you were once 20 and you had no relevant experience. That's true too, and I don't think it's a necessary condition, and therefore that's why I put exploitable horsepower up above. And then lastly, this notion of specific knowledge. And I must admit that I find specific knowledge totally bogus. Every time I've been on a team that's hired for specific knowledge, it's been an unmitigated disaster. Because my view is that people can pick up specific knowledge relatively quickly if they have exploitable horsepower and they can synthesize their experience. Right? And that what you end up doing is hiring people for specific knowledge is that you're not hiring them for exploitable horsepower and you're not hiring them for synthesizable experience, and it's a disaster. The other thing that I think I know now is that there are two sorts of software projects. One which I'll call market or product driven, and the other, which I'll call specific requirements driven. In general, the latter is somewhat unique now to governmental sectors, not totally, but largely unique to governmental sectors. Okay. The thing that happens with a market-driven product is it's a synthesis, and it's kind of a complex synthesis with feedback. You have technology that you may have developed, that you may have acquired, that you may require, right? And a set of market requirements, which in some sense is a surrogate for a need that the market has, or you perceive that it has. And that gives rise to a device or a set of devices. So devices are based in technology and are driven by market requirements. But they're devices, they're things engineers build. And one of the things we confuse, and I think gets very, very confused in Scotland, is the difference between a device and a product. And we think that products and devices are interchangeable, and I don't believe they are. Because you take devices and you support them with a set of collaterals, data sheets, explanations, how they work, or whatever, and a set of intangibles to produce a product that then satisfies a need in the market will buy. And if you want to understand intangibles, ask yourself why, you know, Apple has a sort of 90% share of portable music players. Because if you look at the device, well, that device has certain unique characteristics. And part of that was that Steve Jobs recognized that it was now possible to make very small, very low power, very high capacity disk drives and bought up 100% of the world's supply for 3 years. Which was certainly a crucial technology move. A lot of what makes an Apple iPod is in fact intangible. The crucial thing about this sort of way of doing software, right, other than the fact that you may produce something that no one actually wants, and that's how accurate in some sense you define your market requirements, right, is that it gets to be broken down and implemented in a way that just isn't possible with what I argue are specification-driven products. The first thing, and I think that we didn't understand that back then, that was something that we didn't understand, was the importance of design, right, and look and feel. What the user sees and interacts with, but is a skill, and it's a skill that's best left to designers, people who design courses, and crucially who understand the importance of experimentation as part of that design process. That you put people in user interface labs, you photograph them, you see what they do, and you actually test and measure. That people can't sit in an ivory tower and say, oh, I can design this, it can be perfect. You always have to, in fact, conduct those experiments, put it in front of users, and see what the hell do they do with your nice user interface. The second thing is that I think you can factor most products into hard bits, which is about 10%, maybe it's 20%, and easier bits, the rest. Hard bits are the stuff that have complex dependencies and subtle interactions, and you need a small number, and it's crucial, small number because of the mythical man month, of extremely competent engineers. The rest, in some sense, have contained functionality and defined interfaces, and you can use a much larger number of less competent engineers. And you must get those splits and assignments right. If you get those splits and assignments wrong, you will fail. The last thing is sort of a conundrum. No one ever sees the core. What your users will interact with is the easier bits, the bits that are written by the less competent programmers. And so for you have this dilemma, which is why the difficult stuff may require those very clever people, but the stuff that people use and in some sense informs your product and gives it its characteristic are in fact the easier bits. So in some sense, there's some balancing that has got to be done here, and this comes to management, I would argue, which is how you get the easier bits to look right and perform right, because that's what the user interacts with and sees. Now, I'm a bit cynical here, but I really think this is, to a certain extent, the case. And if you look at things like the systems that are being developed from the National Health Service or the MOD and why they fail, and I'll let you read it for yourself, is you take people who don't really understand what they do or what they need, and certainly can't articulate it if they do, and you have them write the specification. And you allow them then to change their minds, largely because they got it wrong in the beginning and they're going to get it wrong later, but somehow we think that if they can change their minds throughout, it's going to get better. Okay. And you just can't get the splits right. You can't figure out what the difficult 10% of core functionality is versus the 90% that's easier to write. That changes day by day and week by week and month by month. And I think that's why these sorts of projects fail. They fail because they really run slap dab into the mythical man month. And the fact is they can't contain their complexity because they can't get it small enough and contained enough that a small group of smart people can tackle it. Okay, moving on. The other thing I learned then, I think, is don't just test measure. Tell a little story. Some of you who worked on the first EMAS system know this story. I don't quite know why. I worked originally on compilers for Tommy in Edinburgh and then went off to work on device drivers for EMAS. I'm not quite sure why or what experience I had, but I remember the tape subsystem didn't work, and so Harry went, you know, went said go off and fix it, and I read the code for about a week and still couldn't figure out how it worked or didn't work, so I decided to rewrite it, and since that was a success, decided I would rewrite the other ones as well, since I couldn't understand how they worked when I read the code. And crucial to EMAS, it was a three-level hierarchy. If people remember, it had disk system, it had drum system, it had memory, and virtual memory basically consisted of drum memory in which pages were moved into real memory so they could actually be operated on by the CPU. And we formatted the disk, I think, with four sectors per track. I just can't remember whether it was four sectors per track or six per track. And I've asked everyone who might have known except for Harry, who's not here, and none of us can remember any better, but we think it was four. What?
It was
four sectors per track, was it? Okay. And if you read the manual, it led you to believe that you could write a channel program that would read all four sectors in sequence. You know, you could read sector one, sector two, sector three, and sector four. But having written this driver, I decided to, in fact, read the CPU clock and include it as a parameter that basically got logged. And I looked at these numbers, and they just didn't make any sense. I mean, things were taking much, much longer to complete than they should have. And it turned out, and so I went along to the engineers, as one did in those days, and said, could you put a scope on this thing and tell me whether when I go to read the next block, I'm actually getting it? And the answer was no, it was missing it. And so it took about 15 minutes to change the code so that rather than constructing channel programs in which you read a sector and then the next sector and the next sector, you skipped a sector. And so we couldn't able to read eight pages in two revolutions, which we were trying to do, but we certainly did a lot better than reading eight pages in eight revolutions. We actually read eight pages in four revolutions. And at a stroke, more than doubled the speed of the drum subsystem, which is sort of a crucial moment. I mean, if you take something and have that profound an effect, it's important. And it certainly had a deep effect on me. And the problem, you know, the point is that was a performance improvement and was certainly significant. But the other thing that it did that I think is really crucial, and why I think measuring is so important, is that measurement is a reality that you can expose your mental model of how something works against. My mental model of how that drum subsystem worked was that it read adjacent sectors. I had no reason to believe that it didn't read adjacent sectors. What measurement forced me to do is to say, here is a reality, here is a model, these two things don't align. That I have to, you know, the measurement is reality. Now I have to go change my mental model, and I have to come up with a new mental model that fits that reality. And so, yes, hardware has gotten faster and larger. Does performance matter? Well, as long as we have to wait for computers and they're slower than we are, I would argue, yes, it does. Right? But you could argue we're getting to the point where that's less important. But it provides feedback. And I've worked with, as Jeff has done, with a number of companies. And the problem is always this disconnect between the mental model that someone has of how something works and how efficient it is and how fast it is and that reality. And if you don't measure, you'll never know what that reality is. And the third thing I want to talk about was that I guess the second programming course I did was circa 1967, 1968, University of Wisconsin in Madison. And we used Don Noose. Recently published book, Fundamental Algorithms, Volume 1. And there was something written in there that I thought was really crucial, which was that algorithms and data structures equals programs, or are programs. The programs really consist of data structures with algorithms or transforms that are applied against them, right, to get from one state, one data structure state, to another data structure state. But something was missing. And the point is there were no interfaces in that definition of what a program did. A program sort of floated in space and did its thing. It didn't interact with the world and it didn't interact with users. There have really been three ways, I think, over time that we've tried to capture or specify the way that programs should interact and interface to things. The first and by far the most dominant is the application program interface, which is really just a subroutine call through a brick wall, right? And the crucial point is that really is a brick wall. You have no idea of what happens on the other side of that brick wall. You make the call, right? Something happens, and it almost invariably have a side effect. So the order in which you do things has an impact. And it's pretty difficult to debug because how the heck, you know, it's like guessing what goes on beyond that brick wall. You know, I toss something across, something comes back, you know, 2 hours later something weird happens, and I have to figure out, you know, what was it in this sequence of events, right, that led to the side effects that caused this weird sort of thing to happen. Another way, and this is certainly, you know, really required when one's communicating between different systems as protocols, but it's been argued for some time that if we can, in fact, develop interfaces that are protocol defined, that is, involve message exchange, right, and in some sense we can trace the entire context, and while they have state, the state is kind of well-defined because it's very difficult to communicate using a protocol unless you have well-defined state at each side. It's not like an API where just anything can happen. Right? Beyond that brick wall, things get better. And lastly, and I think more recently, and certainly it doesn't apply to communication between between separate computers, but within computers, we've begun to have the idea of a shared data structure. That a program and the thing that it's communicating with share a data structure. And that data structure, in some sense, is in fact the representation of state. Now, the interesting things about that, I mean, one is that data structure potentially has multiple representations. Since we live in a world of object-oriented programming languages, it's an object hierarchy. Right? And events fire at certain points in that hierarchy and aware of the hierarchy and chain back up the hierarchy. But it also, because in fact it's a hierarchy, a tree has an XML representation, and because it's actually a data structure in memory, it does in fact consist of a linked set of records with properties in it. Crucially, as I said, I think the state is manifested in the data structure, and that's important. And so if you look at, for example, the API to the user interface in Windows Vista, and I know Vista gets a whole lot of you know, stuff dumped on it, it's very interesting. I mean, it's somewhat derivative. It's based on the document object model, which is the way that, in fact, code written in JavaScript interacts with the HTML that represents a page, so that when you're in a browser and you hover over something, for example, a window pops up, there is, in fact, an object structure sitting behind the HTML, and when you interact with that object structure, you change it, what's on the screen changes. So the Avalon user interface in Vista operates in a very similar sort of way. You build a data structure. Right? That data structure is shared with the graphics processor. So when you change, when an application changes something in that data structure, it's immediately reflected on the screen. It's very interesting because the way that we used to build windowed operating systems was that everything was the responsibility of the application. You basically said to the application, paint the screen, and that application had to go in at the bit level, right, effectively get every bit back onto that screen. We've really changed the way in which we operate. We're saying that a data structure now reflects the interface. We make a change to that data structure, and something changes in the environment that's reflected in that user interface. Which is interesting because it sort of brings us full circle. Right? The interfaces have gone away. We're back to algorithms plus data structures equals programs. And that's the note on which I wanted to end.